Happy Wednesday, everybody. Desi here from All Access Pass. So with the year wrapping up, the Access Collective, who is responsible for putting this show together, wanted to look back on the semester. So Kaylin, Patrizio, Marco, Deepy, and myself all headed out to Joe's Table Cafe in Burnaby to catch up over coffee and talk about All Access Pass. Joe's Table Cafe, for those of you that don't know, was founded by Peter and Stephanie Chung in 2013 and was made in memory of their son Joe, who had autism and epilepsy. One of their missions is to provide meaningful employment to people with cognitive disabilities. I would definitely recommend checking them out. They are on 5021 Kingsway, right nearby Metro Town, or you can go online at www.joestablecafe.com. That's Joe's Table Cafe without the apostrophe. So today you'll be hearing a bit of our team's reflections on the first half of season 3, as well as some of our favorite moments from the show. Okay, hey, we're here at Joe's Table Cafe here in Burnaby with our team, or part of our team. We have Kaylin and DP and Amy and Patrizio and Marco all here. And we're just hanging out and having coffee and kind of reflecting on this semester of All Access Pass. So in All Access Pass fashion, I have a bunch of questions that I'm going to ask you guys. Okay, so first question is, what was your favorite episode on All Access Pass from this semester in which you did a part or someone else did a part? Whether it's something you did or someone else, like, what was your favorite episode or segment, maybe?
At least in my case, I believe it's maybe the favorite, the one about Hollywood. As everyone participated, we had different stories, different topics, analysis that each one of you did about the movies. It was good. Also, it was really conversational when we had Spencer. I mean, it was his welcome back. But I believe the vibe was good, and also the synergy among all of us.
I would agree with Patrick. I think that the couple of weeks ago when we did the Hollywood films, it really got everybody into it.
Yeah.
And like, it's something that you don't realize it when you're actually watching, but then when you're analyzing, you're like, oh yeah, you know, like, this is something that they didn't cover, or they should have covered, or they did cover, you know? But it's just something to keep your eyes open when you're watching television or TV. And we brought awareness, too, you know? There were some cool actors and actresses who did an interview, and their interviews were very inspiring, and they're trying to bring an awareness as well, just in a different form, right? So that's, to me, it was a really cool thing.
For me too, just thinking, I think I also really like the Hollywood one because we got so many people, everyone wanted to do a film, because once you think about like, oh, is there any proper representation, then you unearth all this stuff. Our topic this week is representation of disability in film and TV, and I can tell you right now we all got a little heated, a little passionate about this week's topic. So this comes in a rather timely period. We've seen a number of movies released with plot lines around disability. However, those playing the characters don't actually have disabilities themselves. These are able-bodied actors playing out disability, and there might be some issues in that, and we're going to go into that today. So some examples right off the bat, we got the film Stronger, which came out this September. The film tells the true story of Jeff Bauman, a man who lost his legs in the Boston Marathon bombing, learned to walk again with the help of prosthetic limbs. He's played by the very lovely Jake Gyllenhaal, who appears quadriplegic with the help of CGI. Just last month, Breathe came out, which leading actor Andrew Garfield spends a majority of the film in a wheelchair as Robin Cavendish, a man who is paralyzed from the neck down by polio. There was also Wonderstruck, starring Julianne Moore, in which she plays a deaf woman. And just last week, a film that you, DP and I were really excited about, maybe not excited for all the right reasons, but excited about, starring Julia Roberts, Owen Wilson. It's called Wonder, and it was released in theaters just last week. It tells the heartwarming story of acceptance for a boy with Treacher-Collins syndromes, played by Jacob Tremblay. Jacob Tremblay, he's most commonly known for his critically acclaimed acting in the movie The Room. Now, Treacher-Collins syndrome is a genetic disorder which causes face deformities. So all of these films kind of point to a larger issue in Hollywood, not just in film, but in TV too. If we look at film, there was recently a report put out titled Inequality in 800 Popular Films by the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. In this report, it was found that disabled actors with speaking roles or even actors identified by name made up only 2.4% of the characters of the top 100 popular films. Furthermore, these disabled characters only played out supporting or inconsequential roles. So there are less disabled characters taking on starring roles or starring predominant characters. TV has also had similar numbers on representation. The disability rights organization Rudderman Family Foundation found that while the disabled account for nearly 20% of the U.S. population, fewer than 2% of TV characters do. Now, this is a problem because within this 2% of TV characters that are disabled, 95% of them are played by able-bodied actors. So how can we understand this issue of misrepresentation of disability in film and TV even further? I'm going to pass this over to Patrizio here.
Okay, for sure. Hi, everyone. First of all, I would like to really congratulate the groups and agencies that promote inclusion of actors with disability, which you already mentioned, Desi. Respectability, KMR Management, Rudderman Family Foundation, and Casting Society of America's Inclusion and Diversity Committee. You're pioneers, leaders in what you're doing, and remember, you're making a difference. When you employ, you promote a disabled actor in a campaign, an ad, or a movie, it means not only that disabled people will support your company or will support your mission as an organization, but so will friends and relatives. It is a way of distinguishing yourself against your competition, and it's a way to celebrate our differences and accept and enjoy the diversity we live with. Desi, you just mentioned some numbers and facts about how accessible Hollywood really is.
Right.
And many of those were the disabled characters with speaking roles or that are identified by name made up only 2.4% of
yep.
characters
yep.
in the top 100 popular films. And after doing and digging on the internet, I could find that, at least in California, there are 870 certified agencies. And so far, we only found four.
We only found four groups. So some of them aren't even agencies, but they're groups that try to lower those barriers. And I remember this was something also we were talking about when we were preparing for this piece, like, you know, how accessible is the whole casting process in general? Groups like, what was it? It was Respectability, which you mentioned, that actually work to make casting and just Hollywood and the production just more accessible in general. And I think that's super important because if we look at this number, 2.4 characters out of 100 popular films, then we look at the even smaller amount of people that are being represented, that actually have a disability, that are representing a character with disability, it kind of points to maybe that there's an inaccessible aspect of how these characters get casted, and why, with that, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you see these films, like, they're quite acclaimed. We got films in the past too, like My Left Foot with Daniel Day-Lewis.
No, totally. I mean, there are many other films, but at the same time, I believe drama schools and many agencies, they're not accessible at all.
Right.
When they are doing auditions, and even consider all the universities when they are doing their admission processes. I mean, sometimes when you want to enroll to drama school, you need to go to the university to do an audition, and some people can't do that.
Right.
Or they don't have other facilities or other means to send applications. So, I don't know, sometimes I just stop for a moment, and I think about many people that dream to become actors or actresses, and they give up their dreams just because sometimes in the mainstream film industry, you don't see too many actors in wheelchairs or with any other disability,
right.
but real ones. As you said, many of them are embodied with people that are not disabled.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this kind of also brings up to this big question for people that, you know, do watch these films. They've seen Stronger. They've maybe seen what's some other films like My Left Foot or Rain Man. And they're like, you know, these films are really inspiring. And I got to learn about the hardships of disability, which then brings up the question, like, then is it okay for able-bodied actors to play actors with disabilities? And that's kind of where we're centering a lot of what we're going to be talking about on this show. You know, when they asked the director of Wonderstruck why, you know this is a deaf character that was casted, Julianne Moore took her part, why couldn't you have pick someone else who was hearing impaired? And he said that they wanted that draw, they wanted to pull in the box office revenue. So,
and you know, the problem with many Hollywood studios is that they try to sell an aspirational view,
right,
to those actors. But right, in acting, I mean, I believe there is much less focus on looks right now, and it is about what can you bring to the character, how you can portray the character. Right. And writers and directors and producers are finally waking up to the fact that there is drama, humor, love, and many other characteristics in actors with disabilities. I mean, sure, one of the examples I really like, because this guy, he has portrayed the roles in which he is acknowledged.
I know who you're going to say.
As a disabled, and in other movies, his disability is not touched at all.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Peter Dinklage.
Yep, that's the one from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, he's a person with dwarfism.
Yep.
And he won an Emmy for his performance in Game of Thrones, and I believe it was really well deserved.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, his character of Tyrion Lannister is nuanced and has great depth, even though his sheer stature is not ignored. I mean, all the characters are always mentioning to him, well, don't forget what you are, which at the same time, you know, Game of Thrones in medieval ages and the stage, it's put a different perspective. But besides that, I would like to emphasize how this guy, I mean, he went to drama school in London, and once he graduated, he didn't allow his size to be an impediment.
Right.
Do you remember, I think, one of the Christmas movies, Elf?
Yeah. That's when you said Peter Dinklage, you went Game of Thrones, my mind went Elf, the Christmas movie with Will Ferrell, where he plays this, like, hot-headed, oh, what was his character? He's some big guy in, like, children's story publishing and...
Yeah, I'm totally sure that guy in real life, he must have a really strong character.
Oh,
because, yeah,
I feel like that.
All the characters that he portrays are, I was like, strong and have a really high temperament. But there are other movies in which his condition isn't mentioned at all,
mm-hmm,
like X-Men: Days of the Future Past, where he interprets this scientist called Bolivar Trask. You remember? The guy, head and CEO of Trax Industry, who mm-hmm creates a range of robots called Sentinels that were designed to find and destroy mutants.
For sure. For sure. I think there is so much to talk about with this topic. And with that, I think we gotta, like, turn it over to someone else. We're gonna just dive into that this hour. And with that, Kaylin.
Yeah, Kaylin, please. We're going to be thoroughly analyzing other films using the famous gold test. So, Kaylin, what can you say about that?
All right, so Jenny Gold created the gold test, and she's a filmmaker known for her documentary Cinema Ability, which centers around disability in film. The message of the documentary Cinema Ability is clear. Those with disabilities are active and critical members of our society, capable of making substantial contributions to not only the entertainment industry as actors, who deserve intelligent stories that don't focus on their disability, directors, producers, and more, but to all industries. This may seem obvious, yet people with disabilities are often treated unfairly or not given opportunities because of their disability, and change is necessary. She is the founder of the Gold Test, which is like the Bechdel test for women in movies. The Gold Test asks whether a work of fiction prominently features a disabled character whose story is not about their disability and whose character is not solely defined by their disability. She created this test after noting that most mainstream films do a terrible job of not only incorporating individuals with a disability in film, but when there is a disability, it seems to be all the movie is actually about. Now, there are a few movies that pass the gold test, including Deadpool, Mad Max, and Creed, but there are many, many more that do not. The ones that do not either fail to incorporate any individuals with disability at all, or they fail to place emphasis on something other than the disability themselves. Researching this topic, it inspired us to take this knowledge and the concept of the gold test into consideration and apply to some films that display disability and question whether or not they pass or fail the gold test.
Thanks, Kaylin. So I'm going to be talking about The Other Sister. Directed by Gary Marshall, The Other Sister was released on February 26, 1999. This romantic comedy movie is about Juliette Lewis's character, Carla Tate, who was born with intellectual disability, and her mother, Elizabeth Tate, played by Diane Keaton, is unable to control her daughter's behavior and disability, gets her maid to handle her young child, and when that doesn't go well, this reason alone, Carla is sent to a special needs school and separated from her family for 8 years of her life. When Carla comes back home to San Francisco from her disability boarding school with great determination and enrolls at Bay Tech Junior College, that's where she meets a similarly unique guy, Daniel Danny McNair, played by Giovanni Ribisi. Through her friendship and later in a romantic relationship with Danny, Carla realizes she can handle her life on her own and be independent like everyone else at her age. The movie doesn't have an actual plot, but it shows Carla's journey on her way for a normal, happy, and independent life. I do think this movie has passed the gold test, because it is about Carla's life, and although she has a disability, she doesn't let it take over her life completely and conquers what she believes in and proves she's capable of living her life the way she wants to live. In a real world, some people with disabilities who advocate for themselves want freedom as well as be independent by making their own choices instead of family members or other people dictating decisions for their needs and mind. Though their characters deal with intellectual disability, Juliette Lewis and Giovanni Ribisi don't have disability themselves. However, the actor's portrayal of Carla and Danny is shown tremendously well and incredibly believable with great emotions that the audience can understand and relate their characters' feelings. In my opinion, The Other Sister is a realistic film where there is Carla's emotional outbreaks of wanting to be accepted by her own family members and showing a strong message of, quote, "Yes, I can if you give me a chance, mother," end quote. Furthermore, the family members in the movie were portrayed very well and natural by veteran actors like Diane Keaton and Tom Skerritt. Diane Keaton's Mrs. Tate is shown on both ends of the spectrum to the audience by wanting to make up the lost years to her daughter and unwillingness to let Carla grow up and be on her own, out of fear and perhaps stubbornness as well. Tom Skerritt, as Mr. Tate, does a remarkably good job as husband living with a past of drinking problems and being there for Carla when she was a child. But he's certainly there for her when she's grown up and basically holds the family together. Supporting actors bring important depth to the touching film, too, with two sisters, Heather, played by Sarah Paulson and Caroline, the character, played by Poppy Montgomery, by adding another layer to the family drama. Caroline is getting married, while Heather, who works in New York, is also seeking acceptance from her mother to acknowledge the fact that treated as a normal person and be allowed to make New York is also seeking acceptance from her mother to acknowledge the fact that she is gay. The sisters also act as a normal or a moral background, stating that Carla be treated as a normal person and be allowed to make mistakes or risks as any ordinary person would. When Carla comes home and sees her mom, her mood changes, and she was shown emotionless, like not making any emotion. So to explain it even further, in this scene, the audience was shown that she hugs her mother, not because she wants to, but because she is her mother and was taught to respect her mother no matter what. In this particular scene, it was very natural for Carla to feel the way she did when she sees her mom after a long time, because she didn't want to create any problems for her mother, and in her mind, if she misbehaves, she would be sent away. Though I watched this movie when it first came out, it was common where there were institutions, not disability schools, out in the 1960s, 1999 era, and people with disabilities would be placed there. Nowadays, though, there is so much, there's no such thing as disability school because there are now group homes, day programs, and respite homes where a caregiver would take in a person with a disability and teach them life skills and other things. This film doesn't show how or what Carla is taught at a special needs school, boarding, but she does mention throughout the movie of what she learned there. When a person with intellectual disability is described as characterized by significant limitations, both intellectual functioning, like reasoning, learning, and problem solving, and in adaptive behavior, which covers a range of everyday social and practical skills. This disability usually occurs before the age of 18. So overall, the movie does have a true definition that with Danny and most of all from Carla's side of things. The other sister is an excellent with romance, emotions, and some humor in it. But most of all, it shows great deal of disability representation and how family members, mostly the parents of Carla, handle their grown-up daughter. With my analyzing on this movie, the same comments were made by most bloggers I've read that were mostly positive reviews with 10 out of 10 marking. And this is a spoiler alert, so apologies for this, but my favorite line of the whole movie was when Carla tells her mom, quote, "We can take care of each other," end quote, and it ends with Carla and her mother hugging lovingly and happily. So if you haven't watched The Other Sister, please do, because it's great.
I also liked when we did housing, because I remember like Patrizio and Taylor really like you guys like did an excellent job. That was you just threw down a lot of knowledge there. It was really good.
Yeah, she did an amazing job. I was really proud of her. You know, that was her first time doing an actual investigating kind of thing. And she seemed really, like, into it. I agree with her. It's too bad that there's no positive, happy news. But I mean, good for her to, like, give that information. And hopefully things change down the road in the housing industry.
So right now, Taylor, tell us a little bit more about what is the current situation with the Vancouver housing crisis.
Well, it's not looking great. In July, Gil Kelly, the head of Vancouver's planning department, estimated that 24,500 households are in need of more affordable housing. Over half of Vancouverites rent, and the Regency's vacancy rate is under 1%. Short-term rentals such as Airbnb have had a huge negative impact on rental and housing markets the world over, as owners can make much more renting units by the night than on a long-term basis. These short-term rentals are illegal in Vancouver, except for at hotels and bed and breakfast, but that doesn't stop people from flying under the radar. Airbnb is currently the city's largest quote-unquote hotel. They have the most rooms of any hotel chain. Studies have shown that the majority of profits from short-term rentals are going to a small number of owners who have multiple properties that are all listed as short-term rentals. This practice has removed a huge amount of rental stock from the market, driving the vacancy rate down. Housing co-ops are another option, but they're reporting 1 to 3 year wait lists, and sometimes they just close their wait lists altogether since the wait would be untenably long. BC Housing, another option, which offers subsidized housing for low-income renters, seniors, Indigenous people, and people with disabilities, also has years-long wait lists. The housing crisis isn't limited to Vancouver, though. Surrounding localities are facing similar challenges. In September, Surrey got its second purpose-built rental building in 30 years. The building received nearly 2,000 applications for 97 units. According to Gordon Price, former director of Simon Fraser University's City Program, there are two main reasons that so few rental buildings have been built in the Metro Vancouver area since the 50s or 60s. First off, the government halted the various tax subsidies and incentives that they had for building rental units. More significantly, though, was the introduction of laws allowing stratas, which kickstarted the era of rapid condominium building starting in 1966. Condos are a favorite of developers as they can quickly sell them and move on to the next one. So gentrification is rapidly eliminating much of the low-income housing options in areas such as the downtown east side in Vancouver. With every new condo development in the area, low-income residents are pushed out of their own neighborhoods to make way for more affluent folks. For those that are able to remain, many are cut off from services as zones of exclusion expand. These are areas that have lost low-cost goods and services retailers as they are replaced with higher-end shops catering to the more affluent new condo owners. This is a real problem for low-income and often homeless residents of the area who lose the ability to purchase the essentials. The latest homeless count found 3,605 people living without a fixed address in Vancouver, and advocates estimate that the number is much higher than that due to the people who may be sleeping on couches or other people who may have been missed. This number is 30% higher than in 2014, so homelessness is a growing problem. Of these people, 83% have at least one health condition, 53% face addictions issues, 44% have a medical condition, 38% have mental health issues, and 33% have a physical disability. The homeless count found that 43% rely on income assistance and 28% rely on disability assistance. So it is clear that the disabled are very overrepresented in the homeless population. And speaking of overrepresentation, 34% self-identified as Indigenous or Aboriginal, while only 2% of Vancouver's population self-identifies as such. So homelessness is a huge problem. Part of the reason Vancouver is facing a homelessness crisis is due to local politicians redefining what low-cost housing is. In 2014, the Vision Vancouver City Council passed bylaws to eliminate the old definition of low-cost housing and replace it with a new definition of social housing. According to a city report, the old definition of low-cost housing, which guaranteed housing for people on income assistance and old-age pension, was quote-unquote outdated. So the revised definition stipulates that social housing outside the downtown east side is any project that is all rental, is owned and operated by a nonprofit or government agency, and rents at least 30% of the units at a maximum of BC housing income limits rates. So these rates are essentially average market rates in Vancouver, and we know how high those are. So under the new definition of social housing, 30% of units in any given social housing project have to rent just below average market rents, while the other 70% of units can be rented for much higher. And all of these units are counted in the city's tally of new social housing. So when you see those numbers that the city releases, keep that in mind. What their definition of social housing is. It's not really housing for low-income people. Rent evictions, I think most of us know what those are, and they're a huge problem as well. No one is even checking to make sure the renovation work has been completed, so it makes for a handy loophole that allows owners to drive up the price of rent beyond what is reasonable. So what's being done about this? Well, currently, as I said, new condo buildings are required by the city to include 30% social housing, but keep in mind what their definition of social housing is. New short-term rental regulations are expected to take shape by spring of 2018. This will free up an estimated 1,000 to 4,000 rental units in Vancouver. Currently, city staff are unable to keep up with the number of complaints regarding illegal short-term rentals like Airbnb. So hopefully this will make a change. A new pilot project along the Cambie Corridor in Vancouver will require all new buildings with over 25 units to have 20% below market rental units. It's estimated that this will create 1,000 new units aimed at those earning between $30,000 and $80,000, or quote-unquote middle-income earners. Rent prices for these units would range from $850 to $1,000 for a studio apartment to $2,100 for a two-bedroom. If the pilot is successful, it could be expanded citywide. The project will require all new mid and high-rise buildings in the area to be 100% rental housing. This is a concept that has found success in San Francisco, New York City, and recently Portland. Since the units are in such high demand, though, the cities use a lottery system to choose tenants. San Francisco estimated that the project will add 5,000 new rental units to the market over 20 years. But officials warned that tens of thousands more are needed, so this isn't a magic bullet. This pilot, however, does nothing to help the most vulnerable who are earning less than $30,000. Affordable to city planners means rents that do not cost more than 30% of a household income. The average price of a one-bedroom apartment in Vancouver right now is over $2,000 a month, so high that if you're making minimum wage, you would not be able to afford the rent alone, let alone any other expenses such as food, bills, medical costs, etc. So I bet you're looking for some good news. We've had some successes. On October 26th, Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister Selena Robinson announced that legislation was introduced to close the vacate clause loophole in fixed-term leases. This is a clause that allows landlords to bypass rental increase limits by stating that tenants must either move out or sign a new lease at the end of the term. Upon signing a new lease, the landlord could then increase the rent by whatever amount they chose. This practice has synthetically increased rental rates for years. The move has been praised by advocates for both tenants and landlords alike. The BC government has also recently made several changes to the Residential Tenancy Act to make it easier to resolve disputes, as well as injected $6.8 million in new funding. And some more good news, a proposed condo development at 105 Kiefer in historic Chinatown was rejected a couple of days ago, a win for the low-income and senior residents of the area that are fighting gentrification, displacement, and racism in the neighborhood. We do have some ongoing challenges, though. Homelessness is the big one. The city continues to raid and demolish tent cities. These are places where the homeless can have safety through community, and yet they continue to be displaced with nowhere to go. This is a real problem. Rent evictions remain a problem, and it remains to be seen if the vacate clause loophole will resolve this issue. The city also recently reneged on a promise to build 100% welfare or pension rate housing at 58 West Hastings Street, a site that has faced a lot of community scrutiny in the downtown east side. Instead of the promised 300 units of social housing, the city unveiled last month that the building could contain as few as 80 units of social housing. The community vision for the site of 58 West Hastings had been endorsed by dozens of local organizations that provide services and advocacy for low-income residents of the downtown east side. So what can individuals do to get involved? You can vote for people like Gene Swanson in the upcoming 2008 municipal elections. Contact your elected officials and tell them that this matters to you, that housing is important. You can also join the Vancouver Tenants Union. Volunteer with the Carnegie Community Action Project, Raise the Rates, or your local advocacy organization, such as Acorn in New West and Surrey, or the Chinatown Action Group. The Vancouver Tenants Union website has a list of all sorts of local organizations, so check that out. They're also having an AGM on November 26th and convention on the same day, so you should check that out as well. Find it online. And where can people, any people, but people with disabilities too, go for support? Well, BC Housing, get on the list. It will take a while, but you might find housing out of that. It is a resource. Also, check out the Tenant Resource and Advocacy Center. They have some great guides that have helped me a lot over the years with housing issues.
Hey there, you are listening to All Access Pass's year-end roundup here on CITR 101.9 FM. Stick around, after the break we got more of our favorite moments and some music, so enjoy.
Hey Matt, are you interested in joining a club that connects you with other musicians around campus?
Yeah, where would I find a club like that?
It's called the UBC Music Initiative. We host monthly events that feature student performances, fun games, and dank food.
That sounds killer. Where can I sign up?
Check out the UBC Music Initiative page on Facebook. We'll see you at our next event.
It's gonna be lit!
Are you interested in Vancouver's local music scene? Then join CITR's Music Collective. We handle all things music, from setting, taken down, and just enjoying live performances to archiving. Join the collective to hang out with like-minded, music-obsessed folks. Open to everyone, no experience necessary. For Word on the Street podcasts and more info about the collective, visit CITR.ca and email volunteer at CITR.ca to get involved.
Listening to 101.9 CITR FM, and you're listening to All Access Pass's year-end roundup. CITR's Access Collective is looking back on some of their favorite moments.
What was your favorite moment while doing a live show?
My favorite part of the live show was probably like perfecting the mic switch off, because the first time we did it, it was a little dicey, but every time since, it's been quite successful, so I'm pretty proud of us for that one.
Yep.
There were many, like the time I was talking and grabbed my mic.
Twice.
Well, also, I remember that moment when you were teaching me how to use the console.
Do
Are you confused with words? Yeah, that's how you turn it on. Yeah.
You know. Said something
inappropriate.
DP?
My moment, I think, was we like to take pictures after, and I think that's pretty cool because we're like all the time we're scrambling around to see, okay, who's going to sit with who, and can everybody get in? And then, Desi, you had to do some poses and really creative moves there, so you can be showing as well, which were actually really cool, but at the same time, very funny. So those are cool moments as well. I don't know, just making sure the mics are off when they should be. Which still, it doesn't matter how many times I've done it, we've done it. I'm always asking Desi, is it turned off? Like,
yep.
Are you sure?
And sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And sometimes music plays during ads.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a little. Okay. The thing I think about now, is when. So, you know, we're behind the scenes and we set up all of our ads that are about to play. And I found a CITR ad and I was like, cool, let's play this. And it ended up being really like lots of screaming, slightly inappropriate content. And we were all laughing in studio. And then we like look out the window because Studio A, which is where we do our live show, there's like glass that you can look into the lobby, and like our volunteer manager and our volunteer coordinator were just looking at us like, what are you playing? And you know, it's a short ad, so I'm like, okay, let's like get this over with. And we're all just kind of awkwardly standing there. So
yeah, I was like, what is that?
I know.
I think a lot of our music too. We're, you and I, or anybody of us, like, we're always scrambling to say, well, how do you say this name? Because for me, like, pronouncing a person's name, I have to get it right.
Yeah.
And it's been, like, a challenge
but
to...
You have some hard ones, too.
Yeah, yeah. So a challenge to, like, pronounce people's name and last names right. Like, I don't know how you guys are doing, but I'm having a hard time.
So my favorite episode of All Access Pass this year was probably the episode on Down syndrome. I thought that Patricio did a really, really good job of giving a different perspective from obviously like a different country and like what disability is like there and what challenges there are no matter where you are, but just how they're different. It's my favorite episode.
I like that episode. Yeah, no, I liked it, and I really liked how you brought your own personal feelings to it, because I think that sometimes it's nice to hear from someone who's experienced all that, and it was really sweet. So yeah, I hope that you can continue bringing more awareness on that, because yeah, it was really well done.
I remember we were all like listening very intently to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Yes, that was basically just my testimony. I mean, about how the experience of raising my brother was.
Yeah.
And so when I heard about the collective, I was like, I want to be part of it. Yeah, and I know that the thing is that being Sutter, sometimes there are people that they don't care about values or any other things that are more important than businesses.
Right.
That's the reason why people from other faculties call us snakes. But I mean, but when I'm looking for relationships, I mean, it can be in the workplace or with you and any other clubs. I am always trying to look at the connections that go beyond.
Yeah.
Something material, but that we are actually being the voice or something, or are helping the society somehow. I think I found that here with you, and in the future, I don't know if well, for the company I'm going to be working for. But I really want to be part of something that actually advocates or supports diversity and accessibility.
So with that, Patrick, I know you have kind of like your own personal story with your family about Down syndrome. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Hi, everyone. Yes, that's right. We'll go through it, and if you have any questions or you want to comment on anything, you're welcome. And one of the experiences that changed my outlook and perspective about life was the birth of my brother, Romeo, 6 years ago. He was born with Down syndrome. So you remember that we were only four before my brother's birth. My parents, my sister, who's now 18 years old, and me. And I remember vividly the night my mother called me and my sister to the family table. She was sat next to my dad and with a look of uncertainty and confusion. Maybe she didn't know how to express a message back then, but then she just said it. You will have a new brother. We're extremely excited about the idea, especially in my case, a young little brother that you can look after and mentor and teach stuff. But my mother also added there was a high probability he could have Down syndrome due to her advanced age. We didn't care. My sister and I told her firmly that we will accept, protect, and love him in spite of his condition. And since that day, I tried to learn as much as possible about Down syndrome scientifically, legally, and socially, what happens, and so forth. That is how I discovered that Down syndrome occurs when a person has a full or partial extra copy of chromosome 21. That's the reason why my brother is stronger than other kids, and he has really high defenses when it comes to illness. Every time he gets sick, everyone in my house is afraid. Because what may seem as a simple fever or a simple, cough or coughing for him is going to be like a something severe for us. Something that will put us, in bed like for 2 or 3 days. So disabled people in Ecuador were once marginalized and considered unemployable. But in 2007, a single government initiative changed everything. They created a new Ecuadorian disability law. And that is how, after my brother's birth, I became really knowledgeable about it. My belief was that if I wanted to create an environment of inclusion and openness, not only in my home, but with the people around me and the community in general, I had to know and understand the legal rights my brother was entitled to, and if possible, to educate people in the path. Because sometimes I found many people that didn't know what Down syndrome was. But we're just saying, as we were mentioning before, people of special needs, or some terms that are not appropriate. So before coming here, I watched my brother's struggle for his life. I shared with him his physical language therapies, his frustrations, and observed his daily progress. And all of that caused me to analyze my own position in the world. I still remember when we were trying to find good therapists, it was difficult. I believe that Ecuador has some things to teach to Canada about disability issues, but it is a two-way street. Canada has many good things, but at that time, just imagine being in a developing country trying to find those resources or facilities for a disabled person. It was a really hard time, but we could finally, through our family work, place him in a really good school with kids that are his same age. Now, for all that experience, that is how I came to understand that I have to continue growing as a human being, and that I came into this world for a purpose. That I know that maybe something happens to my parents in the future, I will be responsible for my brother, for my sister. But I think the most important lesson is what love, unity, and families work can achieve. My brother continues to grow and expand his knowledge with all of our support. Before coming here, one of my concerns was that he was 3 years old.
I came here obviously three years ago, but my parents were like, what if he doesn't remember you anymore as soon as you show up at the airport? As I spent in Canada 18 months straight before visiting my family. But it didn't matter. As soon as I was in the airport and he saw me, he ran towards me and he tried to hug me and he said, Pato, which is the nickname that people use to call me in Spanish. And right now my reflections is that so far it's important to learn perseverance and consistency. Having my brother taught me those qualities, and I experienced solidarity, tolerance, and the meaning of the term inclusion in the life of human beings. I learned the value of each human being, regardless of strengths and weaknesses. Through my brother's work, his achievements, his love and zest for life, and his unique spirit and skill, he's really outgoing, extrovert, and to every girl in his class, he calls them beautiful or pretty. He's real flirty. But well, he has shown me the true value of life and the special value of each and every human being.
Okay, this is the last question.
Yeah. This is the final one.
Okay, so in your opinion,
this is the question
that I made. Who do you think has the best radio voice?
Everybody's actually thinking about this.
Yeah, got people thinking real hard about this.
DB.
I think Patricio, probably.
Was that what you were going to say, DB, when you...
So I had a night to think about this one, and I would say Patrick, or I would say Sophie.
Yeah.
Sophie's done some interviews for us. She's really good at it. So I picked both of you. Here.
I don't want to be biased, so Sophie, yeah. I will never vote for myself, anyway.
I mean, I'm going to do the thing where I say everyone has a really good radio voice, because I generally think that all of you guys, like, have been so good on air, and you guys all speak so clearly, and you bring your own different radio voices, which is always really cool. So, yeah, that's my answer. Yeah?
Yeah. And I think the best, well, hands down, Addison with the music.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's done a fabulous job. Yeah. Kudos to her, and, yeah. We're lucky to have her as well.
Sure.
And Sarah, too.
Yeah, and I think Taylor kills it on the research.
Yeah.
So I feel like everybody brings their own strengths. And, yeah, it's definitely a collective. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. So I guess with that, those are all my questions.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys. We're going to keep enjoying our coffee. And we hope
hot chocolate.
We got a hot chocolate going. London Fog, latte. Green tea latte and hot chocolate. So we're going to enjoy those. You guys have a great, great holiday season. We're still going to be here, but we're just going to be playing music.
Okay, and that wraps up another episode of All Access Pass. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our conversation down at Joe's Table Cafe in Burnaby. If you are interested in joining our team or think there's an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. Remember to like us on our Facebook page. It is All Access Pass. And if you're on Twitter or Instagram, please follow us at @access_CITR. And as always, if you missed any of our live shows or want to listen again, you can listen to our podcasted shows on CITR.ca by going to the search box and searching up All Access Pass. Thank you for listening again, and tune in to our show next week, Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Stick around for Arts Report, which is up next. Bye, everyone, and take care.
There's nothing good about winter. The days are shorter, the sun isn't as sunny, and it's freaking cold.
Yeah, but there's also the annual winter issue of disorder.
pick up your copy of Discorder, that magazine that's salty enough to melt the iciest of seasonal affective disorders from CITR, at one of our over 100 distribution locations. To share some fireside cheer with Kathleen Hepburn, a local independent director, enjoy a cup of metaphorical cocoa with BB over their first full album release, make some non-denominational sugar cookies at Chinatown's Pollyanna Library with Jonathan Q, take a sleigh ride through CITR's seasonal special listening guide, and of course, enjoy reviews of local shows and new releases. And an extra special holiday shout-out to our advertisers, Tambor Concerts, the Rickshaw Theater, the Rio Theater, the Cinematheque, and Mint Records.
I guess winter's not that bad.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have entered a soundstage at
CITR
Studio for a visit with
the folks who are
directing the exciting young star,
Dama,
Dora,
and
guest,
Ben,
the real world.
The Real World is the UBC Film Society's radio show.
We talk about
events,
actors,
directors,
and genres.
We come up with most of the genres.
And that's what makes it so jazzy.
It's a lot of fun and games, except not that many games.
If you think you can handle all of this, tune in Fridays from 11 to 12 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Shout out to Ed Norton!